welcome back. We are at the 252nd. I have to look to make sure. 252nd installment of the Parish of the Patriots. As is always the case, I'm your host, Grandpa Dan, because if I wasn't here, the show would not be here. Whatever's brought you here, I am glad that you found us. If you're new, if this is your first time listening, I appreciate you giving the show a chance. We do have a Christian-specific segment. That's roughly at the halfway point of the show. I encourage you to listen to it. Just give it a try. Even if you're a non-believer, you might get something out of it. I've had people tell me it's not what you think it'll be. It's a lot of fun. You might get something out of it. If you do get something out of the show, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. Yes, this is the part where I done you for money. I know y'all get sick of hearing it, but I do done you for money. If you get something out of it, put something in the plate. This is where I pass the offering plate around. It's easy to look on the description page here for the show on Radio Albin. You'll see I got snail mail, got Bitcoin, got Monero, got email address. You drop your notes at the email address or whatever. If you deal in shit coins, I will take those too, because I'm not too proud to take your shit coins. And drop me an email. I will get you an address for your shit coins. And it will be much appreciated. So with that having been said, let's get into this week's listener supporter mailbag. GPD, there's something for the plate. And that's from Mr. T. Thank you, Mr. T. And listener supporter mailbag is now hereby over. The offering plate was very thin this week. Everybody thumped the bottom of the plate this week. It's okay. I can live with it. It just means we just rocking on. Just rocking on anyway. We just keep on going. So since that's the case, we're just gonna go ahead right into the Christian specific. No, we're not. I do have other things to talk about. I was thinking the other day, you know, and I see all of these. Sven was saying before he went to jail, and Sven would emphasize the importance of focusing on improving and realizing the faults and the problem with the unrealistic, the unnatural behavior that we see in white people. And I believe he was absolutely correct. A lot of people that rubbed him the wrong way. You know, people don't like hear criticism. And I even understand that point of view to an extent, because you live in a society that constantly is running down, ridiculing, blaming everything on white people. And, you know, but there's a difference. You know, what Sven was talking about and what I believe he was correct about, and we're going to get into today. There's a difference from constructive criticism, where you're trying to, you know, make somebody understand, you know, as a group, we're doing this wrong. We need to, you know, get our behavior back on track, versus somebody who's just putting you down. You know, if you've got people in your life who are trying to build you up, they're going to give you constructive criticism. They're not going to sit there and just, you know, pat you on the head and say, oh, everything you're doing is fine. That's not a real family member. It's not a real friend. You know, your real friends are the ones that say, look, dude, you're doing the wrong thing. You know, you didn't get your shit together. You know, if you're out running around cheating on your wife, your real friends are going to pull you aside and say, Brad, what are you doing? You got a wife and kids. Why are you running around with this whore? What are you doing here? You know, you might get mad. You might not like that, but he's being a real friend. He's trying to stop you from making a mistake. He's trying to get your shit together, you know, where the person will just sit there and say, oh, yeah, bro, go hit it. You know, oh, it's funny. That's probably the person that's already got his eye on your old lady. And he's thinking, when that all falls apart, I'm going to be over there. He can be the one bad mouthing you, talking shit about you. Or maybe you have people that, you know, they around your life and all they do is put you down. You know, all they do is tell you, you can't do anything right. You stupid. You know, you're so dumb. You have people that front like they're your friends. You probably at some point in time, if you live long enough, you're going to have one of those people in your life. You start off, you think, this guy's my friend. You know, this guy's cool. This guy hang out. And then you realize this pattern that this person is always putting you down. And they always try to frame it up as it's just a prank, bruh. It's just a joke, bro. You can't take a joke. But this person is actually always putting you down. See, there's the difference. You know, this society is always... This society is always putting white people down. I don't know what we're talking about. What we do here and what Sven was talking about at the time is constructive criticism. We're going to get into some of that today. We're going to get into a little realistic constructive criticism, because you can't change the behavior of other people. You know, you got to focus on your own behavior. whether it's, you know, as individuals, and enough individuals improve their own individual behavior, that's reflected in the group. One of the biggest things that I see as a problem in the mindset of white people is this individualism, this individualist mindset. Now, if you go, you know, don't get me wrong, sometimes that serves a purpose. Like, if you're going to go off on your own and settle the unknown frontier, that individual mindset's probably going to serve you well. You're self-sufficient. You're all about, you know you got to do everything yourself, and you got to do your thing. But that's not the world we live in anymore. We ain't out conquering the old West or whatever the hell. White people have been preached a bill of goods in like libertarianism nonsense and other weird ideologies. And you've wound up with people have this ridiculous individualism mindset. I saw a discussion on the internet, a back and forth. There was one of those discussions about boomers. No, I'm not going to sit here and rag on you boomers. That's not what I'm doing here. But I want to use this to highlight what I'm talking about. I saw this back and forth. And, you know, there's a lot of the same complaints you always hear, you know, from the other generations directed at the boomers. But what was interesting to me is there was a boomer that was responding on there, defending themselves. And this person said something along the lines of, and it was just so funny to me at the time, because basically he was like, basically affirming all the criticisms that people were directing at this person. And I thought, to the point that I thought, well, this is so funny. That's just somebody LARPing. But then I decided maybe not. And what this person basically said is, well, I'm not leaving. My kids don't deserve anything. He said, I'll leave my kids enough money to where, you know, they can pay some of their bills off. The rest of that money, I'm going to go give it to like the teachers at the school to help them out, and the firefighters and first responders and my heroes or whatever. And this person, you know, was saying this, you know, they thought this was, you know, a really righteous thing to do. I saw, and what was funny to me about this is this line, I saw this line in a movie somewhere, and I can't remember the movie. And this shows you how Hollywood, how the media really influences people, whether they realize it or not. I remember, though, this line from a movie. I can't remember what the movie was. And, you know, basically this person was wealthy, and they said, he was talking to somebody. He's like, I'm not leaving my kids anything but just what I started out on. The rest I'm giving away to charity. And you see, people absorb that, and then they think that's their own original thought. And they're bragging that I'm not leaving anything to my kids. I'm giving it to charity. Well, they can start off with nothing, just like I did. Whether that person started off with nothing is realistic or not, I would say they didn't start off with nothing. Because you're not going to make something out of nothing. You got to have something to start with. You might start with very little and build it up to something, but you can. And this mindset, this individual mindset, my kids can start off on their own and start from nothing and build that up. And just like I did, by golly. And I was contrasting, I started thinking about this mindset, not just about the boomers. This is just an illustrated thing, but this mindset in general that white people have, this individual, they can start off with nothing. It's just you're on your own. You know, you got to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You've got to, you know, it's up to you. You got to make it on your own. Probably just about every young white man at some point in time has heard that from their family or the people around them. It's up to you. Man up. Get out there and you know, start doing what you need to do. Take care of business. But it's always like you're on your own. Get out there on your own and figure things out. And of course, this is a destructive mindset. This is why you have people that don't have anything. Straight up, this is. No other racial group does this, by the way. This is a exclusive white people thing. And they think this is virtuous. They think this is righteous. It wasn't always so. You know, it wasn't always so. This is, what I want to say, where individualism served a purpose. Like I said, if you're going out on the prairie and you're going to start digging in the dirt as an individual, you're going to have a pretty good, rugged sense of individualism. But when it gets distorted, and that's what you have now is a unhealthy distortion of this, it's become self-destructive. And people don't realize that, but it is. It's self-destructive. You see it a lot of times. You know, we keep ourselves down with this mentality. My kids are just, I'm going to give them, you know, $500 and a train ticket and good luck, kid. You're on your own. That's white people. That's general white people attitude, isn't it? Like the guy bragging about he's going to go give his money away, all his wealth away to strangers rather than his own kids because he thinks this is some form of righteousness because he saw it in a movie somewhere and he's internalized that as some sort of his own personal morality. And I ask, what other racial group does that? You know, do Jews do that? You sit around and bitch about, oh, Jews have all this power. They're 2% of the population. They have all this power because they're not doing that. they extend it to their extended kin, their extended racial group. You know, they're for sure going to make sure their immediate kids are taken care of. My point is, you know, I'll see white people, I'll listen to white people, and they will bitch about what these other racial groups are doing. You know, how come these damn Indians come in here? Now they own all the convenience stores and they own all the hotels. Well, because they come in as a family and they pool their resources as a family. You know, they don't kick Haji out there and say, well, go figure it out, Haji. We're going to stay over here and keep our stuff. They pool their resources and work together as a group, as a family. You know, that's how they do that. You know, Mexicans tend to do the same way. They come over and they come in and they pool their resources as a family. They know that as one individual, they ain't going to have a chance. But if they pool their resources, they can start building something up. You know, and like I say, an extreme example, you look at how Jews, they look after their entire racial group and they for sure look after their immediate family. They're not sitting there. I can guarantee you they're not sitting around going, I'm not leaving my kids anything. I'm going to give it away to complete strangers. That's ridiculous. The point I'm making is the problem isn't these other racial groups. The problem is this attitude, I'm not giving my kids, they can start from nothing. And you wonder why you look around and say, well, what's wrong with our society? White people aren't doing very good. Well, I wonder why. These other racial groups are doing the natural, normal thing that everybody has done throughout history, which is take care of their family. If you don't have very many resources, pool together with your immediate family. Pool your resources together and try to do something. That's what's normal, what they're doing. You know, what they're doing is the normal thing. It's us. It's white people that aren't doing the normal thing. It's white people that are sitting around going, I'm not going to give my kids a start in life. I'm going to make them start from nothing because this is somehow virtuous. It's absolutely insane. And then you'll hear people and they'll sit around and bitch about these other racial groups. Like they're doing something wrong. No, they're not. They're doing what our people used to do. But for some reason, they sat around, watched Hollywood movies and suddenly got it in their head that that was evil. You should never hold on to family wealth. You should never try to make sure your kids do better than you. I'm not saying everybody does that, but as a group, yes, this is the behavior our group has demonstrated. And this is part of why you look around. They have it in their heads that that's a bad thing. Boy, you don't want to. You want to make your kids struggle and make sure life is as difficult for them as absolutely possible. What the hell? No other racial group is doing that. The problem isn't them. The problem isn't them. The problem is us. The problem is, why do white people have this mindset? They got to get rid of that mindset. My gosh, if you can't look, charity, I always say old sayings are old sayings because they're truth. They don't become old sayings because they're BS. Charity starts at home. You know, if you can't help your immediate family, don't be going around bragging about I sent $2,000 to help starving children in Africa and you're not even helping your own kids. You're not even helping your own immediate family. That's bullshit. And that's not charity. And it ain't Christian. And it doesn't make you a moral person.
I'm going to give my money away to strangers. I'm going to give it to the... Of course, a lot of times that's just talk. What it really means, I'm going to hold on my money and blow it on my own worldly pleasures as much as I can, but I'm going to justify it. I'm going to justify it as actually I'm being a good charitable person. But what they really mean is they're going to blow it on their own worldly pleasures as much as they can. And if nothing's left, well, that's not a bad reflection on me. People got to get rid of these, you know, these misconceptions, these ill-conceived attitudes and ideas. Don't go giving your money away to strangers. Help your family. You sit there and brag about, oh, I'm giving money away to charity. Good night. Take care of your family. That's just crazy to me. Don't brag about, I'm going to give it away to the police and the firefighters and the teachers and help them out. My kids can get, they can make it on their own. And you and somebody say something like that, thinking that that makes them, they're virtue signaling, that they're a good person. Anybody with an eye for the truth is sitting around scratching their head going, you crazy. That don't even make any sense. That's how these other people are doing better. You know, that's how these other people are doing better, is because they're pooling the resources. They help family first. They don't go out and help strangers. They help family first. And starting with immediate family, and then the next step after that is their racial family, their racial kinfolk. This is what all these other groups are doing. That's not a problem. The problem is we're the only group not doing that, because that's racist or something. Now, yeah, I mean, you can sit there and complain about who told you that's racist, but look, at some point, you know it's BS, and you quit practicing that. Stop doing it. By the way, I meant to get off topic here, but I meant to mention this at the very beginning of the show, and I got on a roll early and I forgot. But if you didn't catch last Thursday's Daily Nationalist, his last show of the year, Dr. Johnson, I sat down, did a roundtable show, and you can find it in the Daily Nationalist section. I purposely flagged it where it would come up both in the Radio Albin Roundtable and the Daily Nationalist section, so you don't miss it. But we did a year-end wrap-up roundtable. It was a very good show. Please give it a listen. It's always a pleasure to get to sit down. Matt and I don't get to sit down and do those very often, so it's kind of an extra treat for me, and I think is extra treat for y'all. So be sure and check that out. I think it was a good show. It's always a great discussion. And so be sure and check that out. Of course, now I just completely broke up the flow, but I was pretty much had talked about that all I wanted to. Libertarianism, one of the things I think that's encouraged that is, I was thinking, I don't want to talk about that. Let me change this up. You know, ideologies in general. I'm not a believer in these ideologies, because what it does is it presents this idea that you're going to come up with a set of rules that are going to cover every possibility. You're going to create heaven on earth. You're going to create the perfect society with your ideology. One of the most ridiculous ones is libertarianism, which kind of got me started here. As you just heard, I started to just start on libertarianism, but I really want to paint with a little broader brush here. These ideologies, libertarianism was the most ridiculous ones. And I read some libertarian writers because they have some good stuff. They have some good points. But then they get off into this thing of, if governments at all just didn't exist and we just lived in a society of complete anarchy, as if that is possible. I always shoot that down with, okay, but what's going to keep somebody from just coming and stealing your stuff? I mean, you're going to have some sort of organization. Well, so you would just organize in your own community, and you would have a volunteer force, not a government, a volunteer force of people defending your property. You would defend each other's property with your neighbors. Who's going to organize this volunteer force? Somebody's going to have to be in charge of it. You got to have a hierarchy. Well, somebody in your community, voila, you just set up some form of government. This idea, you're going to have any form of government, everybody's just going to be out hyper-individualists out there, and hyper-individualistly, even though they're exerting their hyper-individual libertarianism, utopia, they're also going to work together collectively. You see, it's a contradiction, it's a gibberish ideology when you get to it. It sounds real good. It's one of those things that on paper, it's like communism. On paper and in theory, it sounds real good. But it's completely unrealistic. You're going to have a hyper-individualist, everybody working on respecting each other's individual rights as individuals in our libertarian utopia. But what about situations where you've got to work together? Like I say, you've got a group of bandits that are coming in and raiding your, you know, violating your libertarian principle and taking your shit. You're going to have to bet, well, these individuals who are focused on their libertarian individualism will then work collectively, voluntarily work collectively to defend themselves. Which is it? You're going to be hyper-individualistic or you're going to work collectively? Because once you start working collectively, you're essentially talking about some form of government, be it crude or whatever the case may be. It's just ridiculous. Ideologies. Instead of using ideologies as an excuse not to use common sense. Let's look at our book of rules. According to our ideology, what do we believe in? This is how the Constitution became ideology. And it wasn't originally necessarily intended to be so. I mean, there was a reason in this country we set up jury trials because they recognized that it is not possible to write a law, no matter how well-intentioned that law is. It's not possible to write a law and write it in a manner to where it's going to cover every single possibility of what could happen. There's going to be extenuating circumstances. There's going to be factors that whoever wrote the law couldn't imagine that particular scenario. So the idea was they set up jury trials. That way the jury could look at it and say, well, yeah, I mean, technically this guy violated the law, but in this case, that's not realistic. We're not going to send him to prison because this, that, or the other was what was going on around it. And it was reasonable. It reaches common sense that he made the decision he was made. I would make that same decision myself. So we're going to acquit this guy. And that's the way it used to work, by the way, in this country. Now they have a jury trial, but they tell the jurors, oh, well, it doesn't matter if you think that way. You just have to go by the letter of law, which makes the jury completely irrelevant. The fact that I refuse to go along, that is one of the reasons I will never be, won't be picked for a jury. But over the years, people have turned the Constitution into an ideology, and it gets used against them. You know, you have a conservative be like, I believe in my Constitution. I believe in my Constitution. But they elevate it to an ideology, which I think, you know, as a root word here, implies it becomes the ideology becomes a form of idolatry. They elevate it to something that it should not be, and it gets used against them. Well, just follow the Constitution. Well, the Constitution, you see, according to the courts, the Constitution means we have freedom of religion. That's right. We believe in freedom of religion. So we're going to set up a satanic temple in the state house, because after all, these government buildings have a Ten Commandments display. And if you respect freedom of religion, you've got to put up a satanic altar as well.
Well, I don't like that. But you know what? According to my Constitution.
No, what the hell are you doing? I have criticisms, plenty of criticisms for the founding fathers of this country and for federalism, all the rest is. But, you know, for all their faults, none of the guys that wrote the Constitution had in mind that you were going to be setting up a satanic altar in a government building, because same as the Ten Commandments. But see, this is where these ridiculous ideologies wind up leading you to. And see, if you argue against that, you're violating your own ideology. And of course, conservatives fall into this trap all the time, because they actually believe in their ideology. They make the mistake, and Dr. Johnson and I touched on this a little bit on Last Thursday's show, they make the mistake of thinking that the left as a power, not necessarily rank and file, but the left believes in their ideology. They just believe in power. The white conservatives are always running around going, I own the libs now. I showed them what hypocrites they are. And they sit around and scratch their heads just waiting for them to have a meltdown because you pointed out how hypocritical they are. And they don't understand why it never comes about, because they don't actually believe in that. They just actually believe in whatever gets them what they want. They're the only ones running around being morons, believing in their ideologies. I don't understand why people are so opposed to the idea of common sense. They want these rules written. They want to be able to go and check the rule book instead of being able to look at a situation and say, well, common sense says we should do this. No, we need to be able to check the ideology rule book and go by that. We can't trust ourselves to use common sense. That's scary. People afraid to think for themselves. And I think that's how it's reflected. They're so afraid to think for themselves that they don't trust anybody else to think for themselves. They don't trust anybody else to use common sense. They got to have a rule book. They got to have an ideology. And they got to consult that ideology to tell them what to do. And any faith and any common sense are going, well, this is pretty simple. You look at this and say, well, this is ridiculous. Put up a satanic temple? No, I don't think so. Maybe we burn your ass at the stake. You know, I mean, really, common sense. Oh, yeah, putting up a satanic temple? What the hell are you talking about? We're going to send the Capitol Guards out there to beat you with clubs and throw your satanic temple out in the yard and set it on fire. And everybody would cheer and celebrate because that's common sense. Instead, they said, well, let's consult the ideology and my ideology of equality. People buy into these things. And even people who are well thought out and do really well in some areas, and you'll see it come back and haunt them, you know. You see people that in a lot of ways, they're really good. And on a lot of points, they get it. You know, they get it. But then they fall right back in. I was reading an article the other day, by Paul Craig Roberts, and he's really good on a lot of stuff. I know Dr. Johnson references him quite a bit. What I don't mean any insult, but he can be such a typical boomer sometimes. You know, he'll sit there and go on. I was reading an article the other day, and he was talking about, you know, complaining about, quote unquote, to use his words, immigrant invaders. And we got all these immigrant invaders coming in, and these immigrant invaders. And he was talking about, you know, how destructive this is. And you know, this is supposed to, you know, why can't we have basically like, you know, what happened to having, you know, countries for white people? And this sounds all really based in red pill. Except at some point, and I've seen him do this several times. Then he says, we used to bring immigrants in and they believed in our values and we became one people. In other words, even though he looks at this disaster and this country, he makes the mistake of acting as though it came out of a vacuum. You see, we used to bring immigrants in and they believed in our values and we became the melting pot. He still won't let go of the melting pot ideology, the melting pot idea that, yes, we see, we used to do it right. No, we got here where we're at because those immigrants were faking it. They were faking it. Where do you think this stuff came from? Who wrote the whole thing, made up the whole thing about the melting pot? It was one of those immigrants that you're sitting here trying to say we became one people. No, they didn't. They just realized at the time they needed to fit in so they didn't stand out. And now they no longer feel the need to do that. But it's just so funny to see this inability to recognize that that's a lie and just let it go. We sit there and oh, yes, this is wrong and that is wrong. And you sit there, nod your head, you know. We used to not do it this way. We used to believe in the melting pot. No, the melting pot was a lie to begin with. That's how one of the reasons we got to where we're at today. We just can't let go of that ideology, that idea, the melting pot. Because, you know, a poem on the Statue of Liberty or whatever. I mean, it's just, no. That's part of where we got here today. We didn't just wake up today and the society, the broken society we live in today just appeared like out of the netherworld, just appeared out of nowhere. Something led us to here and you got all these things over history. That's how we got here. But people can't let go of it. This is what I'm saying. Ideology is just block out common sense. You just sit there and say, well, that didn't work. The melting pot was a lie. That idea was stupid. I don't know. I believe in common sense. I do. I'm a believer in common sense. You use some sense and look at it and say, well, common sense says this is what, you know, as a nation you should be doing. You have to go consult and make sure it falls into the framework of your ideology. All that's going to do is put shackles on you where you can't make the best decisions because you're weighing it against some idol, some fake idol, some idolatry. Anyway, we're going to wrap up on that. Now we need to get in the Christian specific segment. We're going to keep on rolling. Y'all know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon here at the Parish of the Patriots. And this week, I wanted to kind of go back and talk about something we've touched on before. I've been asked several times in listener supporter mailbag in the past, you know, regarding younger people and specifically young men seeking out to get married and wanting to start a family and get their lives on track. And I've answered it several times. And honestly, looking back, I don't think I did a very good job answering it. So just go show, if you ask me something and when I get the best answer I can, which I always do put forth the best answer I can, and you're not really satisfied with that, see, you've got to keep tuning in, because it doesn't mean I've forgotten the question. It means it's going to take me a while to kind of turn this around and it works back around. Your answer may be more drawn out than an instant response. We don't do instant gratification here at the Parish of the Patriots. I wanted to revisit that question of this situation that young men looking, you know, wanting to get married and really wanting to start a life with a woman and have children and begin a family and that being one of their goals in life. Because I do hear about and I see cases of young men, particularly Christian young men, and they're struggling with this issue and how they conduct themselves in this world. And I think one of the things that really is a problem is the fact that when it comes to the question of marriage, there is a category error that takes place. It's really, I was thinking about this the other day, and it's really no different than how we talk about, you know, these MCC people or whatever that believe that the modern nation state of Israel is the Israel of the Old Testament because same name. You know, we talk about that and we talk about how silly that is. But what we don't realize, I think, a lot of time is we ourselves will often turn around and talk about marriage and assume that what we're talking about is the same thing from the Bible because, once again, same name. And it's a category error because it's not the same thing. Young men struggle and will say, you know, you have young men that shore themselves up and say, I'm going to be abstinent and I'm going to save myself to marriage. And this, I'm going to talk about women as well in this and hopefully put it all together where it makes sense. We know... If you're listening to the show, more than likely you understand, you know, that we live in a broken society. We do not live in a normal, in any way, shape, or form, functioning normal society. We have to understand that. And I think a lot of times we forget that because, again, we use the same terms. We use the same terminology and for things. And we lose sight of the fact that what has traditionally fallen under those categories doesn't exist in what we call a society today that we live in. Now, don't get me wrong. As we go through and discuss this, understand that in no way, shape, or form am I implying that God's standards for behavior change and waver and are adjusted for the times. That's a path you don't want to go down. God's standards stay the same, which means this is what makes, you know, no matter what the topic, it's what makes living in this broken society so difficult for us believers. God's standards remain the same. God's laws remain the same. His order of things remains the same. And yet we live in this completely broken, improperly functioning, however you want to call it, society. And yet we're still doing our best to hold ourselves up, to live as close as we can to what God has intended for us. But again, I think we need to understand, I think it's important to understand that in a lot of ways, what we talk about in the biblical sense, and again, we're going to talk about marriage and these things today, it's basically impossible, almost impossible to be by those standards because the society just does not support that at all. And I think that statement makes sense as we go through this. For starters, let's just get to, you know, the bare definitions of what we're working with here. If you read through your Bible, understand that the government, the state, was not involved in marriage at all. that had nothing to do with anything. If you were going along, if a man was going along and he saw a young maiden and he wanted to make her his wife, he would go to her father, or his father would go to the maiden's father and negotiate a deal. He'd have to pay a dowry, and they would work some sort of thing out to where the maiden's father would be compensated and basically sell her off. And when a man took her, when the young man would take the maiden to be his wife, in other words, have sex with her, that was it. That's what made her his wife. Now, there was, as I recall, they would take the next morning after he took her to wife. It was like a ceremony. They go off into the tent together and have sex. And the next day they would hang the sheets out with the blood on it for her losing her virginity. And that bore witness. That would bear witness that she was indeed a virgin. That way, the young man's family, if they were dissatisfied with her for whatever reason down the road, couldn't come back and say, oh, well, she wasn't really a virgin. That bear witness, everybody went by. It's an embarrassing thing to imagine, everybody parading around looking at that, but that's what they would do. And everybody bear witness. Yep, there was no denying. They couldn't come back later and say she wasn't actually a virgin. Because if, for some chance, the wedding night came around and she was not a virgin, then her father was trying to sell them a bill of goods, and the whole thing was off. The point here is to understand, that was it. That was the wedding ceremony. All that there, now you're married. There was no getting a license. There was no going before a judge. What we have today, what we call marriage today, again, this is no different than the modern nation state of Israel. The only thing it has in common with Israel of the Old Testament is same name. What you have today is a contract written by the government. It's overseen by the government. And whether or not she's a virgin has absolutely nothing to do with it. You can be just as married if you go before a priest or a preacher, or if you just go by some judge sitting in a courtroom somewhere. What actually makes the difference as far as the government is concerned is whether or not you pay the money and you obtain the license. You obtain the permission to get married. Again, in those days, you went to her father and got permission to get married. Her father's been replaced in this era we live in now. Her father is now replaced by the government. You go to the government as if that is her father, and he, the government, gives you permission to marry her. You sign a contract, the most poorly written, vaguely written contract conceivable, but it's still considered a legal and binding contract. And it's nobody going into business. I always say, if you were going into business with somebody and you were going to be partners in a business and you sat down and wrote out a contract, you know, that vague as the marriage contract is, and handed it to the other person, they'd laugh at your face and get up and walk out. Nobody would sign a business contract. And yet every day people sign these marriage contracts that they're just basically, y'all are going to be together. Of course, when the contract is, if you go to dissolve the contract, because there's no stipulations, there's nothing specific about, you know, what'll entail what, you know, it's just up to the court to decide. Now, you think about this, if the permission to get married isn't from her father, but from what? The court. It's from the government. So essentially, the government has replaced her father. And if you go to dissolve the marriage, you go to who? The government and the court. So it's like you're going before her father to determine who's at fault in this contract and how things are going to be divvied up. And people wonder why they get screwed in these divorce cases. You're basically going before her father, and he's making the decision for you as far as what's fair and what is not. Now, me being a realist, I say if this is what we have and this is the reality of what we have, the answers to these things are always finding the truth. This is why I think it's so important to get through the life, you know, to seek the truth. Because you get to the truth. When you understand the truth, you get closer to the answer. If this is the system we live under, and obviously it is, then I say, okay, if that's the system we live under, then these marriage contracts should be written specifically. In other words, it should be a multi-page contract, like a real estate contract or a business contract. It should say in there, stipulated, Who's expected to do what? You as the husband, will you agree? You will provide food. You will provide shelter. You will provide this. You will provide all the way listed down. And then her responsibilities, she's going to be expected. In the event one person cheats on the other, or in the event that this is what will happen, and this is how things will be divided. And people say, oh, you can't do that. It's not romantic. What the hell does romantic even mean? It means emotionalism. Oh, no, no. You can't make these. You can't write out a contract in a cold, logical manner. You've got to just emotionally go into it blind. Otherwise, what? You don't love her enough or something. It's ridiculous. You are signing a contract that just basically is written like by a fifth grader or something. By fifth grade, you know, by an 11-year-old girl. You know, just a full of emotionalism imprints. I always say there's a reason why if you go to a marriage, to go to a wedding ceremony, the guy has this serious look of, you know, what am I getting into? And the girl is like, yay, I'm going to be a princess today. Because in the back of their minds, each one knows the ramifications of if this doesn't work out. Again, if it's nothing more than just a legal contract that you're making with the state and the court, then before you get married, that's the way it should be treated. You hire a lawyer, she hires a lawyer, and you hammer out a contract. And of course, women run backwards from this. They say, oh my gosh, you're destroying the romance. Well, you just plan on it not working out. All of these manipulation tactics in order to get you to make an emotional-based decision. And you know, you would hire a lawyer to negotiate out a contract before we get married? She decides to split. She'd be the first one going and hiring a lawyer. Of course, now this isn't the way it's supposed to be. This is just to highlight how absurd this society that we live in now is. But the point here is that when we discuss marriage, what they call marriage in the Bible is nothing like what we call marriage today. Just same name. That's it. That's all basically all it has. That's all it has in common. Now, I was referencing earlier in biblical times, you know, she was a maiden, she was a virgin, and that was a key component of the deal. If the wedding night happened and she was not a virgin, the whole deal was off. You know, that was a deal breaker. You know, the whole thing was off. Now, if you're a young man today and you're out looking for a potential wife or potential partner, the odds are overwhelmingly that she ain't going to be no virgin. I mean, they just be honest here. The odds of you finding a young maiden who is not a virgin are slim to nil. Also understand, I'll get to that here in a minute. Never mind. I have to reel myself in. I'm starting to get ahead of myself. That's the reality. I'm not saying you can't find a woman and have a wife and start a family. Just be realistic now. Again, we're comparing marriage in the traditional sense, and I talk about it in the Bible, but understand this was pretty traditional as far as the ways these things were handled, historically speaking, up until recently. Compared to this thing that we have now. Again, in this broken society, the odds of you finding a young woman to marry and she's a virgin are slim to none. Not impossible, but highly, highly unlikely. And in defense of these young women, the expectations handed down are quite honestly very unreasonable. I'm going to say it, very unreasonable. You have a man, and he has a daughter, and he tells her, you know, you need to maintain your chastity and save yourself for marriage, which, of course, that's what you're going to do. And the young woman would look up at him and say, okay, daddy, well, how long do I need to do this? Till you're about 30. You need to go to college, have fun, and start your career. You see, even as believers, a lot of times, we get sucked into this same society, this same broken society mindset. You can tell these young people, whether it be young men or young women, to abstain and save themselves for marriage. And then on the other hand, you tell them you're going to wait until you're 30. That's not realistic. I'm here to tell you the truth. That's not realistic. They're not going to do that. And by getting the and by giving them these unrealistic expectations, you invite a calamity. You invite an extreme response. If you tell your young daughter over and over, basically she needs to say how important it is that she save herself from marriage. Practically she's going to go to hell if she does not save herself before marriage. And then you send her off to college to run around with all her little hoary friends and to have fun, and they're going to go to drinking parties and you're no longer around. And then she winds up giving that thing up, which she's going to. The odds are that when you send your daughter off to college, you're sending her off to go give that up.
You said, not my little girl.
Yes, your little girl. She's going to be up there giving that up. Now you run into this thing of you've drilled it into her head how important it is that she does not do that. Now she's done it. And now the deed is done. Why not go all in? Why not just become a complete slut? You know, give it up to groups of guys. You see these interviews. You can go on YouTube. Any number of these drunken young girls, young women out doing these interviews. And, you know, they'll ask them, you know, what's some of the craziest things you've done? And it's like, well, I've blown 5 guys at the same party in one night. That's somebody's little girl. And that guy's sitting at home going, not my little girl. She wouldn't be doing that. And yes, she would. You set this unrealistic expectation up, and then once that expectation is broken, then why not go all out there? Why don't you just throw it to the wind? You know, if you're damned anyway, just go on and ride the train to the very end. Flip side of this, you tell a young Christian man, and he's trying to live right, and he wants to abstain from marriage, and then you're like, you know, but you're not going to get married until you're 30. Come on now. Our bodies are designed in these peak fertile years. You read a story from the Bible about, you know, a biblical figure, you know, he's a young man and he gets married. You know, that young maiden is probably anywhere from 13 to 16 years old. That's the reality here. And everybody's cringing and going, oh my gosh, no, because you're looking at today's society. You're looking at today's social construct. That's the reality. Look, I didn't build our body. I didn't design our bodies. God did that. Okay. And young people in their teens have these raging hormones because what their bodies now are giving the signal, it's time to start producing children. Again, in normal days, in those days, you know, a young man was working with his father and building basically his business, which usually consists of either some form of farming or livestock. And he was in a perfectly fine position to start a family and start having children. It wasn't like today where, well, heck, he can't afford to spend $2,000 a month of rent and provide for a family because we live, again, in a broken society. Under those days, under a normal functioning society, when she's a teenager, she should be getting married and having children. I see these videos, like I talked about, you see these videos and these young harlots are running around in their 20s and sitting there in a drunken stupor, bragging about having a train run on them at some party. And I'm thinking, this is not the life she's supposed to be fulfilled. At this age, she should be sitting at home nursing her 4th or 5th child. That would be the life she would be living. Instead, she's out in a drunken stupor as a harlot getting a train run on her at some frat party. You set the expectation for a young Christian man who's trying to live a righteous life and do what is right before God. And he's trying to do the right thing, which he believes is he's not going to have sex until he's married, which is going to happen sometime in his 30s. That's not going to hold. It's not a realistic expectation. It should be, because he should long be married. This whole nonsensical thing, as I said earlier, when a young man in those days saw a woman and is a maiden and is like, I want her to be my wife, they went and negotiated a deal. Hell, he may not even see her. His daddy may be sitting around going, you know, that boy of mine, he's old enough now. He needs a wife of his own. He's working hard here on the farm or working with the flocks. He's really good with the animals. He's 16 years old. He's ready to have a family of his own. And he might be like, well, who do I need? You know, I need to find him a wife. And he knows this other family. Perhaps they're related in some sort of fashion. And he's like, hey, he's got a daughter. And I know this family. They're upright family. And he'll go negotiate a deal. This young man in his teens is out there working with the animals or harvesting in the fields, and he's not even worried about it. Daddy's right now working on getting me a wife, so he knows there's a time coming. He's going to have a wife of his own and start, you know, these urges will be satisfied. He's going to start producing children. Everything is going to work out fine. So we have this nonsensical thing. Where's the romance in that? You know, he's got to date her. He's got to approach her and jump through all these hoops, and she has to meet, or he has to meet her standards of being 6'5" and have a six-figure per month salary or whatever nonsensical crap. Back then, didn't have to worry about it. Daddy's working on, you know, paying a dowry and getting me a wife. It's all going to be good. I remember years ago, I saw an interview with a Indian couple from India. And they were young married couple. And I say young. They weren't young. I mean, they were like in their 20s. And they were the product of an arranged marriage. They'd never met each other before. It was some kind of TV documentary. Of course, it was from the West, so it was tried to present it as, how appalling is this? Oh my gosh, look, India is so backwards. And they were interviewing this couple who'd never met before the wedding night. And they were asking, you know, trying to present it as how backwards it is. And they, of course, they were presenting it to the young woman, the young Indian woman, of how backwards and awful this is. And where's the romance? In other words, why you didn't get to go out and have a train run on you by the football team at college. And this young woman, I remember she looked at the media person and says, well, I look at how things are working out for young couples in America, and you're saying this system is backwards? I mean, it seems to me like it's not what you're advocating here isn't working out really well for y'all. I was really shocked that they left that in the interview. But this young Indian woman was absolutely 100% correct. She's like, look, we're getting to know each other. I mean, if your family arranged a marriage for you, you know, they're going to try to arrange a marriage, you know, for both the young woman, the maiden's family, and the young man's family. You know, they're not going to try to marry their children off to some, you know, shitbag family. They're going to try to marry them off to the best family they can. And I just thought it was interesting that this young Indian woman had the wherewithal to understand that what's being proposed to her was not superior to what she had. This media person was trying to convince her that she had been robbed of a good time or something. Well, you could be out there dating, and you could be out there selecting and making men jump through hoops. It's all a lie, of course. We talked last week about missing your season, you know, missing your chance, and how this, you know, how that works. They trick society tells these young women that that's what they're supposed to do. And then one day they wake up, they're 40 years old in an apartment filled with cats with empty wine bottles laying around and grieving over the fact that they missed their season. To keep things, you know, keep things on point here, it's just important to understand the reality of where we're at. Well, if a young Christian man, if you're a young Christian man, you're trying to hold yourself to, you know, I'm trying to abstain from marriage. And at the same time, the reality is you're not going to get married until you're 30. You're probably trying to hold yourself to a standard that you're not going to be able to attain. And I'm just saying, that's just the reality. Don't go beating yourself up with it. What this means is, realistically speaking, you're going to have to deal with these things the best, you know, the best way you can. You're probably not going to find a young woman who's a virgin. That having been said, you know, as the blacks say, you're not going to turn a hoe into a housewife. Don't go out here and find this young woman that's, you know, been doing group orgies with the football team. She's not going to make a wife. She's just not, because she's broke. It's not even fair to want that out of her, because she's literally not capable of it. She's broken. These are the lies Satan tells people, that, oh, this will be fun. This is the lie of sin. Oh, this will be, you go out and do these things, but what it does is it breaks her. She's broken. She can't do that. She's not capable of it. It's not realistic to expect her of it. So don't. At this point, you know, she's just a harlot. I mean, you know, I don't mean to sound mean, but that's the reality. You're not going to turn a harlot into a housewife. She's broken. Now, perhaps you'll find a woman, she's not a virgin, but she's not been a complete whore either, and she's not so broken that she's not going to be capable of it, and maybe you can muddle your way through. Again, we just have to deal with reality. That's the world we're dealing with. The truth is uncomfortable, but you have to get to the truth to have a better shot at living the best life you can, and living the, you know, and getting through this life and moving forward in this life and spiritually. You just have to understand the truth. It is difficult. I always say I'm very sympathetic. It's very difficult because, again, as I said, as we started this whole thing, God's standards don't change and move around. You know, don't go out there as a young man and say, well, heck with it, you know, and go out there and be a whoremonger. You don't want to do that. At the same time, understanding the reality of the situation, if you wind up laying with one of these harlots, don't spend the next 6 months beating yourself up over it like you've committed an unforgivable sin. Look, it is what it is. Get up and move on. It's just, you know, this is just the truth. It's always important. Jesus said, and I'm kind of moving on here, but I think it segues pretty nicely. Jesus said, one of many of Jesus' profound statements was that the truth will set you free. And I believe that that has much deeper meaning than we give it. I think that applies to a whole lot of things. It applies to your struggle with sin, for instance. You know, the truth will set you free. The secret, I've had people in the past and they'll say, I struggle with this sin. How do I overcome it? You know, as if I'm going to have an easy answer. But the answer is the truth will set you free. Imagine the importance of the truth. Imagine if you were just blindfolded, okay? You were blindfolded, stuffed on a helicopter, and flown into some foreign country and dropped off in the middle of nowhere. And you knew you had to get to the capital of that country to get to the embassy or whatever. You had to get to the capital. But you have no idea where you're going. You see, you've got to have the truth. You've got to have a map. You got to have the direction. You got to have to understand where you're at so you can start heading in the right direction. If you don't have the truth, then you're just wandering around, lost through life. We are basically traveling to the capital in this life, and you've got to have a map. Now, false teachers and false prophets will come along and they'll say, oh, I know the way. Just follow me and I'll lead you to the capital. And that sounds like a good deal because you don't want to wander around lost. You know, you got this guy. And he says, I've been there before. I know the way. I've got the book. I've got the manual. I've got the map. Just follow me. And they're in actuality leading you off in the wrong direction. Now, whether their motivation is just because they're morons and have no clue, but think they do, or whether they're getting paid by robbers, murders, and bandits to lead you off into a trap. Their motivation at the end of the day is irrelevant. The point is they're leading you in the wrong direction. You're worse off than just you were before. You're worse off than you were before just wandering around aimlessly because you don't have the truth. Now you got a false guide taking you along and purposely leading you on the wrong path. The truth will set you free. The truth is always, and you've got to get to the truth. And Satan will do everything he can to keep you from the truth. He wants you wandering around, lost. You've got to get to the truth, and then you understand, okay, I got to start heading in this direction. You got to start this journey in this direction. As I said, I've had people ask me before this. I remember I had a listener sometime back, and he told me, he wrote, and he said, you know, The one thing I struggle with, he was a younger guy, I guess, I'm assuming, you know, is fornication. Well, I love having sex with lots of different women. I know I shouldn't, but this is what I do. In other words, it's not so much even just fornication. It was lapsing, I believe. And I'm doing this, remembering this off the top of my head. If you're that listener, don't be like, no, you read it all wrong, because I'm doing that off the top of my head. It had lapsed from fornication into absolute whoremongering. You know, The secret to getting free from whatever sin you're struggling with is the truth. Jesus said, the truth will set you free. What does that mean? I believe that as you struggle with these things, as long as it's still in the category of you really, really want to do it, but you know you shouldn't, you know, it's like you're trying not to violate a rule, but you really, really, really want to do it, and yet you keep falling to it over and over again, and you're like, I'm never going to overcome the sin. I always hear people talk about overcoming the sin in their life, and they're trying to overcome this thing, and they're just trying, struggling to overcome this thing, and they keep failing because they have the mindset of they're trying to overcome it. It has power over them right now. The truth will set you free as you seek the truth, as you get closer to God. Hear me now. As you get closer to God, slowly but surely you're going to see that sin that has such a control, such a power over you. You'll start seeing the truth in it. And what I mean by that is you'll start seeing it for what it actually is. You see, the devil, he sells sin to you as something pleasurable, as something to enjoy. I talked about earlier the young woman that goes to college, and now once she's been violated, why not go the whole way? And the devil tells her it's going to be fun. You're going to go to this party, and you're going to get banged out by all these different guys, and it's going to be the grandest time. Start you in OnlyFans. Look at all the money you could make, and so on and so forth. And it's peddled off to you as this pleasurable thing. That's why you're having a hard time overcoming it, because in your mind, you're getting something out of it. You're making that choice because you're perceiving it as pleasurable. And as long as that's where you're at, and at some point that is going to be where you're at, again, you got to get to the truth in dealing with yourself. You're making this decision because you're getting something you perceive out of it. But as you progress and mature spiritually and struggle to get closer to God, I think your focus is better placed on how can I get closer to God, not on the sin. How can I overcome the sin? Because you just build it up bigger and bigger in your mind. How can I get closer to God? Focus on that. Focus on that. Because as you grow and spiritually mature and you get closer to the Lord, you know what's going to happen? That thing, you're going to start seeing it for what it is, not the bill of goods that the devil sold it to you as. That thing that maybe right now for you is such a temptation. You perceive it as a pleasurable thing. You perceive it as something you get some kind of enjoyment or some kind of benefit out of. Otherwise, why would you make the decision to do it, right? Because that's what you're doing. The devil isn't forcing you to do anything. It's not some external force putting you in a headlock and dragging you and making you sin. You're choosing to do that because you're perceiving that you're getting something out of it and you're doing it for that purpose. But as you get closer to God, the truth will set you free. You'll start seeing that thing, all the fancy makeup, you know, like you see these pictures and it's like you see it and it's like, oh, that's an attractive woman. And then you see like the makeup is taken off. And you're like, that's how sin is. You know, you might be at the point right now, sin looks like a really attractive woman. But the closer you get to the Lord, all that makeup starts coming off. All the filters on her internet profile, the internet profile of sin, it starts coming. You swiped right on Jezebel. The internet profile of sin, all those filters, all that makeup starts coming off. And you start seeing that sin for what it is. And then you're like, wait a minute. This isn't pleasure. This is something disgusting. You start seeing it. And as that continues to grow, you'll overcome it because you no longer view it as something that you're getting a benefit out of. You view it as something revolting. You see it as something disgusting. You see it, the truth. You see the truth in it. And you see, the truth sets you free because now you're no longer viewing it with the filter and the makeup on. You're looking at this sin for what it absolutely is, and you're appalled. You're like, wait a minute, why? This is disgusting. If you're revolted by it and disgusted by your sin, then the choice is going to start drifting the other way, not to do it. See, and that's a whole different thing from, oh, this pleasurable thing. I really want to go do this pleasurable thing, but I know I shouldn't. I'm over here struggling, trying not to do it. And you lose every time. But if you focus on God and growing and getting closer to God and put that sin off over here in the back burner and focus instead on going, God, as you get closer to God, you will start seeing that sin for the reality of what it is. You start seeing it for how hideous it is, and it will become more and more revolting to you. And as it does, guess what? Overcoming is just something that happens naturally. In fact, you may not even notice. You may look around one day and then remember that sin and be like, wow, that used to have such a hold on me. And now I think about it, I hadn't done that for years. What happened? It just happened. You didn't even notice it happened. And you realize that, you know, then you wind up looking at that thing that you was struggling with and you're like, why was I ever doing that in the first place? Why did I think that was something good to do? Good night. The devil's a liar and a murderer. He's going to try to convince you that you want, you know, to make that decision. But as you see the truth will set you free. And you realize there's nothing pleasure. There's nothing. You're not getting anything out of that. You got to have the truth. You got to have the truth as a roadmap to get you where you want to go. The answer is always the truth. You may not understand how that's the answer, but as you strive, you get closer to the truth. That's always going to be the answer. Looking around, everybody's confused. Everybody's muddled around because everybody's believing lies. This whole society, everybody running around, they got no clue what's going on in the world around them because they're just vomiting up lies. They're just drowning in the filth. The truth will set you free. The truth, you understand. When you understand the truth, you understand the world around you, you're not running around lost like everybody else. The answer is always the truth. We're going to wrap up on that note. Hope you got something out of it. Hope you got something out of this Christian-specific segment. And I hope you got something enjoyable out of the whole show. I thank you again for joining me. Hope you'll join me here next week for another installment of the Parish of the Patriots.